I'm Jamie Dew.
I'm Greg LeGros.
Of the Fully and Completely Podcast.
And you're listening to
Death Watch
on Modern Superior.
This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed. My name is Matt Brown. Sitting across the table from me,
as always, Matthew Price.
And today we'll be looking at the life and career of chef, author, documentarian, world traveler, philosopher king, Anthony Bourdain, who died by suicide quite suddenly on the 8th of June of this year. We're recording this on the 19th of July, so a pretty hot follow on that one. And you'll be listening to the episode starting on Friday, the 27th of July. We're hosted at the Modern Superior Network. You can listen to many fine programs there. I believe I'm going to put a bumper on this episode for Fully and Completely, their show about the discography of The Tragically Hip, hosted by Jamie and Greg. But plenty of Frame Apart. All these. See you next Wednesday. I joked in the last episode that they were dead. They're not. They're just biweekly, which is like being dead. But I'm not going to follow follow that thread any further down the line there. No, sir.
Oh, boy.
But we've had a big month since the last time we recorded, so this is now time for roll call.
Are we already doing roll call?
Yeah, let's get right into roll call.
Oh, let's get right into it. Okay, so it has been a big month, and like literally, I think the day after we recorded the last time, Coco,
yeah,
Coco,
I think that was
the
next
sign day. Language gorilla, sign language, signing gorilla, passed away.
Yep,
and so I found that I found it fascinating how impactful. First of all, Coco was in that category of celebrities that I was like, are they still alive? I didn't know. I thought.
Oh, I would not have. I couldn't have picked that Coco was still alive.
I had no idea. I thought Coco had in fact passed away. But like, I think because the reason that it had sort of an effect on me is because to me the strongest association with Coco is Robin Williams, because there's this great footage of him talking to her.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing about Coco is that one time she was bad and blamed her pet kitten, which I think is the most amazing. She was like, she did some messed up her room or something, and they were like, Coco, who did this? And she pointed at the cat and was like, cat did it.
Yeah.
Kazuo Kashio. Do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
The founder of Casio.
Really?
Kazuo Kashio.
Wow.
Yes, the founder of Casio. So without him, we wouldn't have many actually pretty cool things like little keyboards, things like that. Richard Allen Greenberg, film title designer, most notably for The Matrix, Alien, Predator, and Die Hard.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, those are some titles, man.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Like, especially Alien has some pretty great titles. Like, those are amazing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Charles Krauthammer, who was a talking head, conservative Fox News pundit.
Great.
Best known for his signature phrase, you've been Krauthammered. No, it's not true. Dick Leach, who was a gay rights activist in the U.S. pre-Stonewall. So, like in the 60s, he was doing sit-ins. So there were laws in place in the U.S. that you couldn't. Men couldn't order drinks at the bar if they were accompanied by other men and stuff like that. And it was he broke and protested all of that stuff, and it was sort of like the precursor to Stonewall. So.
Wow, how would you and I order a drink at a bar in that case?
No, I know it was weird. it was selectively applied.
Do you show your ring in that case?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right,
it was selectively
great.
Applied. James Gipps, who was an inventor, he invented something called Eagle Eyes, which led to sort of modern accessibility software for websites, so the ability to read out what's on the screen and stuff like that.
Cool.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. Two different notable rock and roll drummers, Nick Knox from The Cramps and Vinnie Paul from Pantera, both passed away around the same, almost on the same day. Donald Hall was a former U.S. Poet Laureate. Troy Hurtubise died. Name sounds familiar?
It does.
Project Grizzly.
Of course.
He is the subject of Project
Jesus.
Grizzly. Built the suits. Passed away.
Wow. How did he die? Please, not a grizzly.
No, no, but in something I think equally grizzly, other word grizzly.
Mm-hmm.
Scion and notable abuser Joe Jackson.
Sure did.
Passed away.
Yep. Very close to the anniversary of Michael's death, if I'm not remembering incorrectly. I think it was like 2 or 3 days before.
Yeah, if you believe in an afterlife, he's up there wishing him a happy birthday by beating the shit out of him.
No, I don't think that's the version of the afterlife I believe in.
No, probably not. Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a huge one.
Yeah, and a weird aftermath to his death because there's been some talk that he was abusive or to women. And I've seen the clip that purportedly is this abuse towards a woman, and it's... Like, it is dubious at best, I would say.
I don't know, obviously, and I'm, at this day and age, more than willing to believe that a man was abusive of a woman. Harlan Ellison was a fucking dick. Like, he was not a nice guy.
No, he's an asshole.
Yeah.
For sure.
Like,
but I don't think he was especially an asshole in that direction.
Yeah, it's possible he was an all-around dick.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously an amazing writer and more importantly, an amazing advocate for writers, like a real don't let them fuck you kind of a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis Akiyama, Toronto character actor with over 100 film credits. He was the bad guy in Johnny Mnemonic. and he was also in Dead Ringers. And if there is an episodic television show produced in Toronto in the last 30 years, he was in it.
Cool.
Gillian Lynn, who was the choreographer for Cats.
Wow.
Among many other Broadway shows.
Wow.
But notably for Cats, right? Because that has some pretty distinctive choreography. Alan Longmuir from the Bay City Rollers passed away. Stanley Anderson, who was a character actor, played the judge in the finale episode of Seinfeld.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that guy died.
Yeah. Derek O'Connor, who was a British character actor, most notably played the bad guy Peter Vorsted in Lethal Weapon 2.
Oh, that guy.
Kind of a long, pointy face guy. Very squirrely looking.
Yeah. Yep.
Robbie Mueller.
Yeah.
Cinematographer for, among others, starts with Wim Wenders in the 70s, is sort of picked up in the 80s by Jim Jarmusch. Also has time, while he's working extensively with Jarmusch on pretty much all his films, also seems to have time to do Repo Man, To Live and Die in L.A., Barfly in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, then gets picked up by Lars von Trier, does his best films, Breaking the Waves, Dancer in the Dark, also worked with Sally Potter and did The Tango Lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you like independent cinema, he's half the reason.
Yeah. He's important.
That you like it.
Yeah.
Because if you like it because of how it looks, it's almost all Robbie Mueller.
Yeah.
Right?
Huge influence. We obviously looked at Paris, Texas, and a little bit of Repo Man when we did Harry Dean Stanton in our first episode.
Yeah.
But we are seriously considering a circle back to the works of Robbie Mueller, and we'll decide if that's going to be our August show or not.
Yeah, yeah. There's some good stuff there.
Yeah.
Claude Lanzmann, who was the director of Shoah, among many other films, and who I learned actually after he passed away. And this is, I think, Shoah is incredibly impressive, you know, as a kind of a just an achievement, right?
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, that guy broke into North Korea.
Oh, really?
To make a film about the what's going on in North Korea. He was in his 90s. Like,
well done.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's dedication.
Yeah. Another political kind of person, Ed Schultz, who hosted his own show on MSNBC, was sort of famously gruff, no-nonsense kind of guy on MSNBC, but not very old, I think only in his 50s.
Wow.
Passed away. Steve Ditko.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other front runner for me for person we should think about doing a show. I have no idea how we would do a Steve Ditko show.
I guess we would look at stuff he wrote that's been adapted to films, right? And I thought about that, too, is like, it would be an interesting one to do because he was so reclusive about what his actual contributions were to things.
Yeah.
But I do think maybe what we should do is all three first Spider-Man movies or something.
And there's an idea.
Yeah.
Do all of the reboots. Yeah. I mean, and also, like, you know, it gets buried under the fact that he helped create Spider-Man. He also created Doctor Strange. And I love that.
Yeah.
That that's his idea of interesting comic book characters. The Spider-Man. And the Wizard.
Yeah.
Saying, that's terrific.
Yeah. And I also think you have to put it in the context of his being an absolute fervent devotee of Ayn Rand.
Yes.
And all the positives and negatives that go along with
course,
that, right?
Yeah.
Tab Hunter.
Yep.
Famous cheesecake actor from the 50s.
Yeah.
Who, in fact, turned out to be, for lack of a better word, not just a pretty face. He was a very he's you know, he's one of the first out actors in history. He his work with John Waters is tremendous and fucking brave, to say the least. Yep. Especially for a guy that had been known as being just sort of this bland studio system guy, and he, you know, he, from all accounts, a generous and important guy that worked towards, you know, freedom for gays and lesbians and like all this kind of good stuff.
I mean, I feel pretty bad that I didn't know much about his extracurricular work when I heard that he had died. Like, I just sort of knew him as, you know, that brick from the 50s. And you know, fortunately, I work in an environment where many people are willing to quickly bring me up to speed on the importance of that person to the history of
gay rights.
That
is good.
Yeah.
That
is
good.
It's nice. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think if you watch the work he does in these John Waters films, he's just really canny, right?
Yeah.
Now, the author of one of my favorite books growing up. So one of my favorite books growing up when I was a young man was a book from the UK that I only found out, you know, many years after I read it, was actually really old. It's a book called Stig of the Dump. Familiar with Stig of the Dump?
No.
Did you ever
read
it?
I've not heard of that.
It is a wonderful book about a little boy who is sort of alienated, and so he goes to hang out at the dump because he doesn't want to be around any of the kids his own age.
Sure.
And he finds a caveman living there and makes friends with him and names the caveman Stig. It is really, really great. It's written by a man named Clive King, who wrote lots of other children's books as well. Anyway, he passed away earlier this month. Stig of the Dump is wonderful. If you have kids yourself, it's a book I recommend easily to any person sort of 9 to 12. Alan Johnson, also a choreographer who passed away, most famously choreographed the musical numbers in the movie The Producers.
Oh, cool.
So worked with Mel Brooks for his whole life. So he is the one that choreographed the goose-stepping Hitlers. That's a very important achievement in the history of film.
Singular.
It really is, and incredibly valuable, I think.
Yep.
George Jensen, who was a noted film illustrator, are you familiar with?
I know the name. What did he do?
So when we say film illustrator, I think what we're really talking about is conceptual illustrator, although he may have also done matte paintings. I'm not, like, actual production art.
And sometimes the film illustrator is the person who does, like, if they have, like, laminates on a screen or something like that.
So worked very closely with Spielberg, did Close Encounters, did, like, a lot of the E.T., a lot of those types of sort of, you know, rock-solid films.
Interesting.
Nancy Sinatra Sr., Frank's first wife, and Nancy Sinatra's mother, and died into her hundreds. Quite tragically and recently, a former NHL goalie named Ray Emery was vacationing and decided to take a swim in Hamilton Harbor and never came back up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he was only in his 30s.
Wow.
And yeah, and I just put it in there because I think it's...
Hamilton?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's a hockey player. He's Canadian, right?
Yeah.
So he was with his friends over a long weekend.
Yeesh.
Decided he'd go for a swim, dived in, disappeared.
Wow.
And they, you know, they found his body, but yeah, he drowned. And it, again, a former athlete in his 30s, so not a guy who was, you know, I think, so, you know, very strange. And I apologize for this going so long. As I said, this was a terrible
this
month,
a
terrible solid month of deaths.
Yep.
I have one more late entry happen today, I think, or yesterday. Yvonne Blake, who was a costume designer in Hollywood, notably the costume designer for Superman the movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So designed the original Superman suit, all of Luthor's clothes.
Yeah.
Which, come on.
Which means also all of Otis's clothes.
All of Otis's clothes. and that flowy dress that Margot Kidder wears. Yeah. And like, oh, man. Like, yeah. And and the stuff, the Jimmy Olsen stuff. Like, all the clothes in Superman the movie are note perfect.
Well, I mean, I maintain that one of the things that is most interesting about Superman 1 is that it is three distinct genres of a film in three different acts.
Which they say themselves. Yeah.
It's a science fiction
movie. It's a science fiction movie, right?
So, science fiction.
Right. Then it's like a John Ford
Western farm.
And then it is a metropolitan New York City comedy.
Yeah.
Sort of urban comedy.
Yeah, exactly. And it just nails all three of those styles.
Yeah.
Which just endlessly fascinates me.
So that is...
That's roll call. All right, so let's talk about Anthony Bourdain. I'm gonna do this one a little bit differently because I just want to sort of lay out how this all happened to me, because, you know, why not Please. Make it? Why not make someone's death all about you? But I just think that the way this transpired is the reason that we're doing the show today. So yeah. I was in Sardinia when I found out about the suicide. I was with my family. And I'm going to preface this by saying, so my siblings had literally been like watching his episodes, particularly his Sardinia episode, which I also watched for this program today. Just to, you know, and many others, they were just, he was in the house with us while we were there.
Okay.
And I had just, whatever it was, 2 or 3 weeks earlier, read the IndieWire article that about him. And I read it because I was interested in Asia Argento, who had shot the
sure.
Hong Kong episode
sure.
of his show. I think up to that point, up to the moment I'm describing right now, I didn't really know who this guy was. I don't think I even mentally connected that he was the guy, the Kitchen Confidential guy. I don't think I
right,
put so, those
and you
names
had not
together.
Read, you had just watched the Kitchen Confidential.
That's
TV
right.
Show.
As we discussed before yeah. we decided to do this, you know, you and I are probably the only people in the world who actually kind of liked the Bradley Cooper Kitchen Confidential show, watched
yeah.
it while it was on
yeah.
the air.
Yeah.
You know, so I. Obviously, like you hear about the death, and it is one of those deaths of which I can remember basically Robin Williams and Carrie Fisher, where the internet goes crazy. Sorry, bad choice of words in this case, but it, you know, like I'm across the sea and I am watching just waves and waves of grief for
yeah,
hours
an astounding,
and then days.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, I think it's interesting. It doesn't have his death did not have that impact on me personally the way those others did, but to see the impact
yeah.
on, as you say, these waves and waves of people who for whom his life was not just like it was a meaningful thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I wasn't familiar with the work. So I sat down, I read the New Yorker article that basically was the basis for Kitchen Confidential. And it's an incredible piece of writing.
No, it's the book, right?
Or no, there was an article in 99.
And then that was
and
fleshed
then
to the
that
book?
Was fleshed. That becomes the book
okay.
in 2000.
Okay.
And it's an incredible piece of writing. This is going to sound like I'm taking on an entire culture, but I will say it is written so well that I did not understand that this man was American. You know, it is. I was like, this is a British man, surely. Like, the command of the word is so
yeah,
exceptional.
He's a wonderful writer.
Yeah, yeah, an incredible, incredible piece of writing. And again, as this is happening, everyone's sharing their knowledge of him and their feelings about his death and what the show meant to him and meant to them. And I obviously was like, well, you know, and I need to, whether we do him for the show or not, I need to learn more about this man. So here is what I learned. So he's born June 25th in 1956 in New York, which, again, no shit if you've heard him speak, which I had not up until that point. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this man mm-hmm. is from New York. He claims that he became interested in cooking after tasting a raw oyster off of a fisherman's boat when he was a child, which I think fits, whether that's mythology or not, ladders up perfectly to the, you know, experiential of the moment approach to world cuisine that basically informs all of the series that he went on to do. Goes to culinary school in the 70s, cooks his way up the chain in New York through basically the end of the 20th century when he decides to write this tell-all book about what it's really like in a restaurant, like basically what you're actually getting when you're buying
yes.
food.
Yes.
And it remains amazing to me that he gets away with that at all.
He
possibly,
was only able to do it because he had left restaurants.
Yeah, exactly. But
you know?
Possibly
yeah,
a function
yeah.
of timing. Like, I think if you did that now, if this was the first time that something like that was published, like right now, everyone would just go apoplectic. You know, like everyone is so
yeah.
fussy right now about all of these ideas. And he's basically saying, look, this is just the way it is. This is the way the industry runs. This is the way people are, you know, behaving. You can like
yeah.
it or not like it, but like
but
a lot
not,
of the
yeah.
pretension around food is
when you,
in your mind.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he's the first person that sort of brought home that when you work in a kitchen, you work in a factory.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
is factory work.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, whether or not, I'm not sure how it would be received now, but I do think what's really notable about Kitchen Confidential is that there is a before and an after for Kitchen Confidential. So there is absolutely a chef culture
mm-hmm.
that didn't exist before. There were cooking shows.
Yep.
There were celebrity chefs.
Yep.
But there was not this kind of, I don't think you'd see books by people like Jen Ag.
Mm-hmm.
And the books are that are about the sociology of running a restaurant as opposed to the food.
Yeah.
That only exists because Bourdain essentially invented it.
Yep.
And there's a million examples of it. And so that's, to me, like the big cultural moment in terms of that book, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting to me that from that point, he doesn't go and do, you know, a three-camera cooking instructional show like Nigella.
Right. When did he start doing television?
So he starts doing television, I believe, in
2000. It was later, right?
No, he starts in like 2003. He moves around from network to network. So he starts on Food TV, then he goes to Discovery, then he goes to CNN.
Okay.
Basically, the concept of the show is similar in all cases.
Are you talking about The Layover? That's the Travel Channel. It's not Discovery.
The Discovery is, what the fuck is the name of that show? I got it here.
Okay.
No Reservations.
Okay.
You're right.
Okay.
Layover is on the Travel Channel. It's between No Reservations
right.
and Parts Unknown. And then I think one of the more, you know, the best things I most meaningful to me is that he described himself as an advocate of what he called peasant foods, which is that he's less and less interested in, you know, the haute cuisine aspects of this
right.
industry and more interested in what do people who don't have a lot of money eat. Famous advocate of Popeye's chicken, for example, you know, like he's just sort of like, and he was also a big advocate for the people who cook using all the parts of the animal. Who are using the pieces of meat that are not necessarily the most
right.
Renowned, but you can do interesting and different things with them as a result. Obviously, he's also a huge, in the last couple of years, he comes out as a huge supporter of the Me Too movement, possibly directly because of his relationship with Azzia Argento, possibly just because he's a good guy, hard to say. But, like, you know, there's quite a bit of sexism in the food industry that we are all, to more or less degrees,
aware
of. And
that is, it's important to note that he was complicit in and then came to renounce. Like he's a good example of how you can manage through your personal growth without seeming like without being beholden to your earlier self.
Right He says everyone, good-hearted or not, will have to look at themselves, the part that they played in the past, the things they've seen, ignored, accepted as normal, or simply missed, and considered what side of history they want to be on in the future. So he's not saying wipe the slate clean. He's
right.
saying
pretend that
let's
never
have
happened.
A reckoning and move forward intelligently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, just on a personal level, I'm such a fan of Azzia Argento, and it really, you know, she was the first person I thought of when I heard that he had died. Like, I was just like, what a horrible thing for her and for obviously for his family as well. So, and I thought it would be worth mentioning. You know, we touched on mental health issues a little bit when we did the Carrie Fisher episode. I just thought it would be worth mentioning that at least as of this recording. And please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. There is no sound theory on why this man decided to commit suicide on an early night in June.
No, there's some absolute garbage about a behavior that she
she's
garbage.
Yeah,
total
she's being
that
bullied.
There is no sound theory. There is, however, you know, I heard this described really well recently. This idea that people kill themselves. In some sort of selfish way or all of this. And that literally the right way to think about it is that they're in so much pain that they actually can't stand it anymore. And this is the only way to make it stop.
Right.
And that nobody does it not thinking about the people in their life. If anything, they've been thinking about the other people in their life nonstop, and that's the reason they haven't done it yet.
Yes.
And that it just overwhelms them. And I think that's, you know, that's as close as we're likely to get. Did he leave a note?
I actually don't know if he left a note or not. It certainly hasn't been publicized
Even if he did, who thinks the note can sum up everything?
Right.
Like, and if you were that self-aware, you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
Right? Like you know, I don't believe that someone can capture in a note all the reasons that they're about to do this irreversible thing. If they could, they probably could get some kind of intervention before the note was finished.
Well,
written,
I mean,
right?
hopefully.
Yeah.
The reason I bring it up is just to say that even that idea that, you know, when someone famous dies, and we saw the same thing after Robin Williams committed suicide, the idea that, well, there will be a solution to this puzzle. We will learn something that will explain to us why this person did what they did.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just do what they do.
I think there's some of that, but I don't think we're ever going to learn why he specifically did it. I do hope that at some point we are going to learn what it is about our environment and the world we have unfortunately created for ourselves to exist in and its connection and its sort of intersection with our brain chemistry that is leading us in general to do this.
Mm-hmm.
right? I don't think this is, I don't think that this is just an isolated thing of brain chemistry and a lack of serotonin.
Right.
It is environmental. We have created an environment, an existence for ourselves to live in that is somehow profoundly lacking in something or over-indexing in something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, for some of us, triggering it to our brains to signal bad shit. And
yep.
I just, it's a combination. It's, we have to do both.
Yeah, so. It's possible.
Yeah.
I can't actually remember what you watched for the show. I watched several episodes of his program.
I did watch about, I think, four episodes of The Layover.
Okay.
Including the Toronto episode, which
nice.
Is bracing.
Yeah? How so?
He starts the episode by saying, oh, this is an ugly fucking city.
He's right.
Yeah, I know, but I live here.
I know. But he's right.
This is a city that Stalin would like. You know, like, it's that kind of shit where I'm just like, yeah, whatever, man. Just settle in, you know?
Yeah.
And
hey, man, it's no Edmonton.
Yeah, no kidding. I happen to think Toronto's beautiful in its neighborhoods and in a lot
Toronto
of smaller aspects.
Toronto has some beauty. Yeah.
But it's, you know, its skyline is not beautiful, and that's what he's judging the city on, right? So I watched a few episodes of The Layover.
Yep.
I don't think it's remarkable.
No?
Like, I think, I haven't seen Parts Unknown. Coincidentally, yesterday, all 8 seasons came available on Netflix here.
Yeah, it's weird.
So I
had
well,
finished the research for
I
this
know,
show.
And I know, and then it's
boom.
Like, oh, all
actually,
of it.
It's actually not the whole show. The show is 11 seasons long, but they dumped the first 8 this week. And I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Should I just watch more?
Well, anyway, so I'm going to try... I suspect that it's one of these things where if you start from his earliest show and work your way forwards, they get better in the sense that he gets to be more in control and understands better what he wants to do.
Right.
So The Layover is like, it feels a lot like sort of regular reality TV.
What's the premise? Is it just he's visiting restaurants or is there like a larger
No, it's
arching...
that it's the pre- it is on the Travel Channel. So the premise is you are in a city starting from the airport for that city. For a set amount of hours, what can you do?
Oh, Jesus. No wonder he hates Toronto.
So he is in Toronto for 43 hours. And they pick, I mean, it's a arbitrary amount of hours, right? And it's, so it always starts with him reviewing the airport for the city, and usually poorly.
Yeah.
And then reviewing the modes of transportation from the airport to get into the city, and then going to various places in the city and saying, you know, if I was this kind of person, I'd go to this place.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not, so I'm going to this bar.
Yeah.
And like that. I watched the Chicago episode and had thankfully gotten to about half of the places he got to.
Yeah.
Went to Donut Vault.
Nice.
So we've been to Donut Vault.
Yep.
And the other half that I hadn't been to, I was like, I'm putting those on my list.
Absolutely.
They seem great. And I think there is value in these shows for like putting things on your list when you're going to go somewhere. But it does feel like sort of standard reality TV, you know, let's get back to him and watch him quip off the cuff, quote unquote. And then we'll like show you some B-roll, you know, like it's like whatever. It's fine. What I really watched for the show for this was the movie Burnt.
Ah.
And I watched that movie, even though he himself has no involvement in it, because for a number of reasons, because it so clearly got some DNA back to the Kitchen Confidential show. It is about Bradley Cooper playing a formerly drug-addicted chef who is trying to rebuild his career.
Yeah.
That is the premise of Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah, I mean, I really loved Bradley Cooper on Alias, which is why I followed him into Kitchen Confidential. I had no idea he was going to become the going concern.
Well,
he is
very talented.
Yeah, and I adore that he connects so solidly with Bourdain as a character that he's actually tried to play him twice.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. What's really interesting to me about Burnt, do we want to talk about it now?
Hit it.
Is how much it is about people who took the wrong things away from Bourdain because there are a lot of those people.
Yeah.
So the if you really want to think about Kitchen Confidential, it is absolutely a bro culture bullshit. The stuff that he is atoning for later in his life, it is all there.
Yeah.
It is a bro culture bullshit, fuck a lot of waitresses, nonsense thing.
Mm-hmm.
The executive producers of this movie are Mario Batali, Gordon Ramsay, and the fucking Weinsteins.
Jesus.
Okay?
Christ.
So that rolls in the opening credits, and I'm like, here we go.
Wow.
This is ground zero for all the bullshit nonsense. This movie is exactly like a minute before Me Too.
Wow.
Right? So it's fascinating in that respect.
Yeah.
Fascinating to watch a movie that is just before. Right? Yep. So all the shit they're celebrating is wrong.
Yeah.
And so the movie is glorifies this guy's attribute, this guy's shitty attributes.
Mm-hmm.
The character arc of the film is that he goes from being an abusive asshole to being a slightly less abusive mm-hmm. asshole. Like, it's one of those movies where you're like, oh, he's starting to not be quite as much of an abusive asshole. I guess I like him now.
Yeah, terrific.
You know?
Yeah.
There is an overimportance on getting the food right versus being the right person. Like the arc of him is to go, maybe the food doesn't have to be the thing. Maybe me not being a dick has to be the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're like, yeah, that's, we all know that, mm-hmm. you know? So,
bless men.
It's a very male movie. Sienna Miller is the only woman in it, and she has the role of only woman in this movie.
you have boobs. Bring them over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The food is, again, it's that thing of like being authentic by having him eat at Burger King once. Like taking the ideas of Bourdain, which are, you know, we shouldn't be so concerned with we shouldn't be about technique. We should be about reality,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely missing the mark on it. It's boy, does it have Batali's nonsense with towards food written all over it.
Right. Yeah. That's too bad.
No, it's fine. I mean, like on that level of like understanding what I was watching, I was pleased to watch it. It was fine.
Well,
right?
that's what will be interesting about this entire era is that we will get to visit movies from immediately before and even long
before. The only comparison I can draw is to like watching a solid blaxploitation film where you're like, boy, the politics in this are all fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, boy, this is fun to watch on that in that context.
Yeah, and also because you can look at it in that context and be like, boy, these people are fascinating.
Dolomite is not okay.
No, it is
but
not.
But man, it is fucking fun to watch.
Yeah, it's fun to watch. I mean, Human Tornado, arguably even worse.
Yeah. I still haven't seen Superfly or The Harder They Come. Like, you know, these are good movies about very, very bad people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I watched, again, I was kind of new to all of this, so I just watched a bunch of Parts Unknown and then threw in one No Reservations because it happened to be the Sardinia episode. So I took very copious notes, which I'm not going to bother to read right now because nobody really gives a fuck. But I will say, so I will highlight three episodes that I watched. So I watched the Canada episode of Parts Unknown, which is in Newfoundland, and the reason I'm going to highlight these first two is that I was just delighted by the number of things, like you said, that I'd actually done.
Isn't that great?
It's just
so great.
Great. So when he's going on about how fucking great scruntions are, I'm like, I love scruntions. I wish I had some scruntions right now. That's
are those
terrific.
Are the scruntions the cod tongues?
No, that's the you take pork fat and you fry it up.
Okay, and so it's like rendered like chicharron.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's great.
Yeah,
and then he gets screeched in at the same bar by the same guy that I got screeched in.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So that was pretty terrific. For those of you who don't know what screeching in is, it does involve making out with a frozen fish.
Yep.
So bless
Kiss
you
the cod.
For that exactly.
Kiss the cod. Yeah.
And then in the Sardinia episode, you know, like a bit less there because he was in a slightly different part of the country, but he did go to Nuoro, which is sort of the culinary capital of Sardinia, which is like this mountain town where they have the rarest pasta in the world.
Which
I also ate.
Yeah,
I did.
What is it?
It's called Filandeu, and it's made by, and I'm not fucking with you, one woman.
Yeah, okay. Is it like filea? Is it rolled?
No, it's like it makes angel hair pasta look fat. It's an extremely fat pasta, and you serve it in a sheep broth.
And it's cooked for a second?
Basically. I can't imagine it would have to be cooked for more. I think you just basically put it in the broth and you're done. Nice. Yeah, so I had that, and that was all very exciting. And it was just nice to, you know, like, I mean, I found out about Bourdain's death when I was in Sardinia. It was nice to go back to Sardinia with him. It was also a little bit weird because it was, that episode's from, like, 2009, so he is noticeably younger, right? Like, he has
the darker hair.
And his vocal tone is a lot more playful and stuff like that. He's with his wife and his child, who obviously he got divorced from and was with Azzi Argento now.
I can't tell you what a joy it is to see all eight sort of cover shots from the 8 seasons of the CNN show,
yep.
and like watch him age in real time on those cover shots. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's wild.
And he gets sort of thinner and sort of better looking as he gets older.
Yeah, yeah. But the one I want to really highlight, and I am not alone in this, but I just think it's pointing out the Hong Kong episode of Parts Unknown, directed by Asia Argento and photographed by Christopher Doyle, is
of course they are
fucking masterpiece.
Yeah, that's kind of neat.
That is an incredible piece of television in any genre.
In what season is that?
That is in season 11. That aired.
Oh,
that
wow.
aired not 3 months ago. It was the basis of the IndieWire article that I read just before I went to Sardinia. It is unbelievable. Hong Kong was never on my list of places to go, and I still would not go for tourism-related reasons.
Sure.
I would go for beef brisket noodles with wonton purchased at a Dai Pai Dong, like just like he does. Like the fucking shit that he shows just in the food is incredible. But because, like, I mean, what's so fascinating about the episode is that the food is half of it. And the other half is just him finding his way around sort of street level Hong Kong that is being actively wiped away as he's going. Over the course of the last 20 years since China took it back over, the Hong Kong that we all emotionally understand from movies and pop culture and just our childhoods is being aggressively taken out of the picture. These little food stands down on the street are being closed. I think when they filmed this episode, they said there were 28 of this particular type left in the city. You know, like, so he's just cataloging these pieces of texture that are just being taken out of the world even as this episode is airing. And, you know, and again, because it is being shot by Christopher Doyle, who is hilarious. He also appears on camera a few times. He's so excited. He's lived there for 30 years, you know. Marvelous.
And he's a wonderful human being.
Yeah, wonderful personality and just great fun. I so impressed. Put Hong Kong right up on the list of places I need to get to in the next 10 years of my life.
And unlike quite a lot of Asia, a very accessible place for an English-speaking person to go.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That 60 years of British rule doesn't hurt.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely.
Hey, look, street signs.
Well, it does hurt, but it doesn't
hurt. Well, it doesn't hurt us.
Yeah, exactly.
The important thing is us. You know, when there's a tragedy in a country, I think is, hotel rates are going to go down.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that was my experience with this. I mean, I feel like I was only at the beginning of this process. Like, again, all these episodes dropped on Netflix, and I was like, well, that's what I'm doing all summer, but that's...
Yeah, I think, to speak in the vernacular of sort of shows in general and maybe like where the influence is for this.
Sure.
I think at its worst, what he did leads to a show like Somebody Feed Phil.
I don't know what that is.
So that is a show on Netflix where Phil Rosenthal, who was the producer of Everybody Loves Raymond, and by all accounts, a lovely, sort of gently funny Jew, goes to places and has people show him the food,
okay.
right? And it's but it's very much in the vein of a white tourist going, "Why, this is delicious!" You know, like it's very silly, right? And at its best, it leads to a show like Ugly Delicious, the David Chang show, where he. And that is a show that I would absolutely recommend to everybody to watch, whether you care about food or not, because what he does is to go one food at a time all around the world.
Interesting. So that's a really neat
approach.
So
he does a show on tacos and goes to Korea and Denmark and Mexico and East LA and does tacos.
Right.
He does a show on pizza and goes to New York and Italy and right?
That's cool.
And does it with great people around him. And clearly... You know, Chang is the owner of Momofuku, and he, assuming, had a relationship with Bourdain, and absolutely seems to have taken his cues in terms of how to be on a show like this from Bourdain.
Right.
So,
for me, the thing that I take away, which maybe it's just more aspirational for the work that I do, that we do, that you know, this podcast falls into, it, anything, it's just that anything I think his show shows that anything can be about whatever you want. It's a show about food and it's a show about travel.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, the Armenia episode is also absolutely a 20-minute documentary
about genocide
and diaspora and the impacts of generational change. Yeah. And he does all of that within the context of a food show. And I'm like, well, that's just like, there really are no rules. You can find, if you have a structure, you can layer on anything.
Well, and truly, food is that thing that is the gateway into a million other things.
Exactly.
Like, I think I have always tended to travel in the same way that he does these shows, in the sense that I like to travel for specific meal experiences mm-hmm. in specific places that relate back to the history of those places.
Yeah.
Because that is neat, right? Yeah. And yeah, and I think it's it always is about the history of the place.
For sure.
You know?
And I'm just like, it's very easy when creating anything to sort of think that you need to and I would even put travel within this boundary.
Yeah.
It's very easy to think you need to stick to the rails. You don't.
Right, you can go like, anywhere, and people will be happy to see you.
Yeah.
And try, you know, and, or you might die, but whatever.
Well, it's, absolutely. It's but you know what I mean? Like, as long as you have a structure, you can improvise around the structure with anything you want.
Yeah. I also want to point out, just between you and I, because mm-hmm. we are kind of...
But we're recording this.
I know.
Oh, okay, okay.
We're on a break from going to the U.S. pretty
yes,
much.
Yes, that's
which we have done in the past quite a bit. When that break ends, which we hope will be any day now, we in watching the Chicago show... Boy, we missed the boat on the hot dogs.
We did?
We really did.
You've been talking about that hot dog place pretty much nonstop for 10 years. You telling me we went to the wrong damn place?
We went to... The place was fine, but we didn't go to any neighborhood places. And in the show, he goes to the neighborhood places And I'm like, oh, man, I missed the boat.
Yeah.
Should have gone to the neighborhood places.
Yeah, I've got this weird thing that I've never successfully done that I've kind of started to want to do, which is I want to taste the best version of something in the world and then never eat that thing again. So
nice.
I've had what is supposedly the best hot dog in the world in Reykjavik, and I was like, that should have been my last hot dog. I don't like hot dogs enough that I could
that
keep eating hot dogs after
giving
that
them up. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But I obviously did. And then I had what I considered to be the best fish and chips of my life in this tiny little stand on a beach in New Zealand. And I was like, well, that should have been it.
The,
I should have
the
dropped
door on
the
that.
Mic on that.
Yeah.
So let's find some of those experiences. And then if I'm satisfied, you may
you
see
can
me
retire.
Go, that's it. I have retired this food type.
Let's see if we can make you do it with Eggs Benedict.
Or pizza.
Yeah.
That'd be... if you.
I don't think that's possible.
I mean, look, I don't like the films of Robert Rodriguez that much anymore. And God knows I no longer like Johnny Depp. But the thing in Once Upon a Time in Mexico where he says that the puerco pibil is so good that he's going to go into the back and shoot the cook. And then he does it. I feel that.
Yeah, okay, sure.
It's like, this has to cease to exist.
All right, well, I feel like that's a good
that's
as
fine place
shoot
to
the cook. That's as good a place as any to end the Bourdain episode.
Absolutely. So thank you all very much for listening. You can follow us on Letterboxd and Twitter at DeathWatchPod. You can leave comments for us at Modern Superior, although, honestly, I don't know if anyone ever goes there for that purpose. So if you do, maybe throw me a tweet.
Let us know.
And I'll go have a look at it. But thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next month. Haven't quite decided on the subject. Mentioned a few potential candidates in roll call, but we will
TBD.
Post the decision on Twitter at the beginning of August, and we'll see you all then. Thanks, and have a great rest of your day.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.
Just give me one quick second. I want to check the New York Times obituaries just to make sure.
In case anyone dressed like
miss
slid
anybody
in,
today.
Slid
you know.
In just under the call.
Yeah. No, I'm not just. You betcha.